Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out on a 11:30 a.m. Panel after the first night of the music festival. It's very much appreciated. My name is Ryan Groves, and this panel is on how open AI models enable artists to innovate. So I thought I'd start it off with just a round of introductions, of self-introductions, and we've also got some examples of our work that we'll share with you, and I'm excited to have this conversation. Jane, why don't you start us off?
Cool. Hello, my name is Jane Adams. I'm a PhD student at Northeastern University, specializing in data visualization within the College of Computer Science. But I'm also a practicing emergent media artist, everything from immersive installations to, during the pandemic, I got really involved in creating AI art. So happy to be here.
Hi, I'm Delina Tran, and I'm also a media artist and an educator at UCLA currently. And my work is usually revolving around video and animation, VFX, and thinking of like the newest ways to engage with moving images. Happy to be here. Thanks for coming.
All right. Hi, and I'm Hans Brouwer. I'm a master's student at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, and I also make music and visuals to go with the music, and lately, I guess the last 5 years, I've been really diving deep into machine learning, which is also what my master's is in, and so I'm interested in generally the intersection of audio and visual through algorithms. Thanks for coming.
Thanks. And my name is Ryan Groves. I'm the co-founder and CTO of Infinite Album, where we generate copyright-free music for Twitch streamers that adapts to gameplay. It's all AI-generated in real time. And another thing that I do, I'm a volunteer, a co-organizer, and on the jury panel for the AI Song Contest, which is now in its third year. And last year we had 38 teams from around the world who co-created songs with artificial intelligence. So we had quite an extensive jury, and we rated all these songs, which took quite a long time. So I wanted to kick it off by just sort of addressing the public conception of artificial intelligence. So I think we have some practitioners here, so it would be interesting to get their perspective. How do you define artificial intelligence?
I can start off, I guess. I think for me, artificial intelligence, it's really a loaded buzzword. And so what a lot of people think of it is kind of a bit different than really the reality. I like the term creative machine learning a lot more than AI art, just because it really gives you a better idea of what this really is. It's really just kind of higher dimensional fancy statistics. It's not really conscious or anything that artificial intelligence kind of implies. And so really, these are just algorithms in the same sense of if you were to write a couple for loops to do something for you. And the interesting thing is that at some point you set it off to let it figure out what the best way is to reach a target, but you're still the ones setting these targets and telling it what it should be trying to do. So I really see artificial intelligence as a tool for artists.
I really like the joke someone said. It was when you're talking to investors, it's AI. When you're talking to your boss, it's machine learning. And when you're talking to your coworker, it's linear regression. But I do think that there is benefit in leveraging buzzwords sometimes, because if you tell someone it's just math, it's just stats all the way down, someone who's like a self-proclaimed not a computer scientist or not a math person might not really be interested in learning more about it. So in that regard, I think that using the term AI is beneficial, but we do need to kind of temper our expectations.
Yeah. I would agree with both of you on that, and I think artificial intelligence is sort of a way to think more sophisticatedly with computation and work with it as a tool, at least for me as an artist as well. So.
And Do you find that there's a distinction between artificial intelligence and machine learning, for example? And because there is something when you get into this sort of higher dimensional mathematical space, you know, there is this whole field where we don't know exactly what's happening some of the time. So do you find that, do you feel like there's particular areas of machine learning that are more about artificial intelligence than others? Or like techniques?
Yeah, I think definitely like machine learning is used more often with regard to utility. And artificial intelligence, I think, comes with this aura of consciousness or creativity or like all of the things that maybe we over-optimistically ascribe to, you know, as potential uses for AI. So, yeah, there's a certain, it's almost like artificial intelligence has sort of like a humanities bent to it also, I think, that that is absent from the like sort of more clinical definition of machine learning.
I think maybe one way of looking at it could be to think of the more black box-y whatever system you're working with, the more it kind of tends towards artificial intelligence, just because we're having a harder time of explaining exactly what's going on, so then it seems more intelligent to us. But I guess that's also kind of the main strength of machine learning and artificial intelligence in general, is that these condensed representations kind of encode more information in kind of a higher level way that we're not exactly sure what's making something angry or sad, but there is some underlying variable that if you have the right data and the right algorithm, then these machines can pick up on this. And so maybe I think artificial intelligence is pretty strongly correlated with our understanding of the system.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. You know, this black box sort of, these black box approaches, black box means like you can't see into the box, so you can't see what the model is doing and what decisions it's making. For those of you who haven't heard that term, but yeah, I think I would agree that, you know, I think the whole hype around AI is that we don't know kind of what its decision making process is. And to me, that is actually pretty magical, and that tends to enable creativity more so than other models, in my opinion, because you have to just sort of like let it do its thing, essentially. So this panel is on how open AI models enable artists to innovate. So what are these models when you train an AI or a machine learning model? What actually happens there in that process?
Well, I could speak specifically about StyleGAN because that's the model that I use the most. And despite everything I just said about artificial intelligence and us, you know, maybe putting too much weight into it, I do think that anthropomorphization of the neural networks is a useful metaphor. So with StyleGAN, it's actually two neural networks that are kind of in conversation with one another. So one is the generator. So you could imagine that this is the like the artist in the scenario, and the other neural network is the discriminator, kind of like the judge. And the discriminator kind of asks the generator, hey, you know, make me a picture of, say, a plant. And the generator hasn't seen any plants before, but it starts generating images. And the discriminator either says, yes, that's a plant, or no, it's not. And they sort of continue this back and forth until finally the generator has fooled the discriminator. And at that point, the generator kind of gets a reward. It says, nice job, you fooled the discriminator. But also, the discriminator gets some feedback, and it finds out that it's been fooled. So it becomes better at judging images. So what's actually happening is both networks are kind of learning, and they're playing this game back and forth over a really long period of time in order to generate those images. So that's kind of how I think it's useful to think about that. So the discriminator sees the real images and tries to differentiate from the generated images, and the generator is just learning from feedback based on what it's gotten back from the discriminator.
Yeah, that's a great description. And I think generative adversarial networks, what they're called, is one of the prevailing techniques for creativity, I think. I think you could say that in sort of the neural architecture space. And it's specifically because of this interplay between those two agents, essentially. And so when if I'm a practitioner and I want to use a model, how do I create a model, and how would I share a model, for example, with other people?
I guess I could kind of generalize this idea of what Jane was just explaining. Oftentimes, I guess the overall process is you have a set of inputs and a set of outputs that you would like your network to make. And then through the training process, you learn a function that kind of transforms your inputs to your outputs. And this function, in general, for neural networks, and also simpler stats models, is really just a collection of matrices that you multiply one after the other with the input until you get your output. And so when we're talking about a model, it's really just a pile of linear algebra functions. And if you save exactly what functions to apply and the exact values that happen to be in that matrix that have been put there through the training process, then someone else can kind of run and get the same outputs for their own inputs. And that's kind of where the creative aspect comes in, is that when you change these inputs, you'll also change the outputs. And kind of passing these pre-trained models around can give you a system that has a really strong kind of understanding of the input to output mapping, and so you can kind of probe it and understand, maybe not necessarily understand, but see what the outputs are like, and oftentimes that's really inspiring.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good description. And I think lately there's been quite a boom of, companies and people who are making all the effort of training the model, collecting the data, designing it, and then they just share the trained, matrices essentially with everybody else, and then everybody else can go pick it up and, infer new output essentially. So that has actually really sort of revolutionized the industry quite a bit. So I think this would be a great time to take a look at the examples that we have. Now that we've sort of set the scene for what is machine learning, what are these models? I can't actually remember the order. Let's see who's first. Hans.
All right. So I'll kick this off. I also do most of my work with StyleGAN as well. I initially got started in about 2017 with something called the deep convolutional GAN, which is kind of a precursor. And in the last 5 years, that was generating like 32 by 32 pixel images. So it's really small, and you can kind of see that it's generating what you want, but it's really not that expressive. But in the last years, it's gone so quickly that now we have networks that can generate full HD video in real time for you. And so this, what's on screen here is a still image at the moment, but I'm mainly focused on generating videos with a StyleGAN. And so this is a network that was trained on images. So basically you give it a folder of images and it learns to map random noise to an image. So you basically generate some random noise and that maps to a single image. But the really interesting thing about StyleGAN is that this kind of random input space is really well organized. So if you have one random output over here in space and another one over here, all of the points between it also have meaningful image outputs. So if you interpolate from kind of one side to the other, the image smoothly changes from your first image to your next image. So if you're smart about generating the path, you can make the video, which is really what a sequence of images is, have some meaning. And so I published a paper at the Neural Information Processing Systems conference at a workshop on creativity, not this past conference, but the one before, in 2020, I guess, was the conference officially, but I guess it was in December, so it was 2019. But In any case, I published on making audio reactive interpolations with StyleGAN. So I'm crafting my inputs by analyzing some music and then generating these random inputs based on the music. So this first video is based on a chord progression. I have a simple chord progression, and each note is mapped to one of these random inputs. These are called latent vectors, and that's because this is the underlying latent representation of the images that I've trained on. And so whenever a note is playing, that latent vector will get a stronger weight, and so the output image will look a bit more like C. But so if you start out with an ACE chord, it'll have a certain look, but if you then change your E to a G, then you'll get a bit more of the G vector in there. So if we can go ahead and play it, you'll get a better idea. See that every time the chord changes, the visual is changing as well. And what I've kind of glossed over so far is that these latent vectors, they're actually 512 dimensional. So this space that we're mapping from is huge. It's incomprehensibly large space. And what makes that interesting is that even if 12 notes, you're not using too much of that space. So you can kind of combine multiple different interpolations that are based on different audio inputs to generate kind of combinations of the outputs. So on the next slide, we've got something similar where instead of analyzing chords, I'm analyzing a drum break. And so whenever the drums are hitting, the visuals will change. Together on this slide, we've got chords and drums. And I guess this is kind of a bit of an illustration of it, but you can do a lot more with this kind of system. So this is just taking only the chords and only the drums, but you could incorporate things like analyzing maybe a violin comes in at some point, and then the visual will change based on that. And there's a bunch of ways to control the network to change the output, and you really have a ton of freedom to morph kind of this video sequence based on any number of inputs you could imagine.
Yeah, and we'll show you. I've got another example that Hans and I have worked together on a couple of things. Since I'm generating music, and he's generating visuals from music, you can get a pipeline where you can just generate an entire audio-visual experience. So we'll see more of that in a little bit.
There's a question in the audience.
We'll take questions towards the end, but if you can remember them. Delina, do you want to tell us about this work, Incomplete?
Yeah, so I work in relationship to the other panelists here, kind of backwards. I'm usually more of a 3D artist, a 3D animator, and I worked a lot with compositing in the industry and was really interested in it. And so a lot of my background is, you know, working in a 3D software and animating and using actually, before working with AI, hyper-real textures or sort of thinking of world building in a way. And then when I saw that NVIDIA about 3 years ago released this this paper and basically this model, I think it's called Spade, and they had a tool that was using Spade called GuaGAN. And basically what it allowed you to do was you could use values between 0 and 1, and you could create a value map, which became this
black and white image of a grayscale image that would be mapped, that would map photographic objects to the image. And so I saw that as a really strong parallel to the way that compositing works in the industry, thinking about alpha channels and blending and all of these aspects having a very similar relationship. And I thought that it would be a great way to sort of pair these. So being able to create like a semantic synthesis, which is what Spade is as a model, to pair that with a 3D animation. So this project is basically a music video that I worked with a UK musician, Ash Kusha, and he made the song already, and I was really into this song. We're really good friends, and I really wanted to work with this, with his audio, his music for this project, and trying this method and seeing what would come out, because the song itself, as you'll quickly listen, is pretty unstable. There's like a lot of discordances, and there's a lot of sort of glitchy sounds to it that aren't, at first listen, not very harmonic, but there's something underlying that I really liked about it that I could kind of pair with the visual method. So I'll play a little bit, and then I'll talk a little bit more about the process after the fact.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so with this project, it was really interesting because it was not like I was interested necessarily in working with AI and constantly working with AI, but I think for the purpose of the song and the concept of the song, it being about incomplete and this kind of, at least for me and Ashkan, when we were talking about the music itself, conceptually, is thinking about the future, or like just in general the inability to predict the future. And so when thinking of, you know, AI and machine learning and how you have this relationship of working generatively with the idea that some things are not really predictable as you're working. But I liked this process because there are things like the animating, the camera movement, and the certain objects that you see on the screen are intentional, while there are things that are left to the algorithm to decide what ends up being the output. And having that kind of like back and forth. And it took a lot of trial and error to get to the point that it is here. But I do enjoy that aspect of it. And if you could go to the next slide, I can show basically kind of the process a little bit more. So I'm basically using Blender, which is also an open source software. And it's, if you don't know much about it, you can download it for free. It's a, you can basically code your own add-ons, and that's what we kind of did with this pipeline. Is what you see this image here, these gray values between white and black, are all distinct objects in the 3D scene that have just been flattened. So if you can imagine, they're actually in the 3D graphical software as assets, but and models, but how they're rendered is just a flattened kind of color and texture. And that allows for me to process these images through Spade and basically semantically synthesize the image to which is the second image that you'll see, which is the final output, minus the post-processing and all of that. And what happens here is it's basically a data set of over 167,000 images that it's trained on different objects in the world, so trees, humans, birds, bridges, all these different things. And it's always sort of dependent on what is in the image in relationship to each other. So the image and what gets output may change depending on if a human is in there with a tree versus if a human, or if a tree is in there just with a mountain. So it's really interesting how adding objects and removing objects in relationship to each other actually changes the final output. And so that also took a lot of kind of playing around with, and that's where I think a lot of the creativity also comes in, is kind of speaking and thinking in relationship to the algorithm you're using as well, and the process, and sort of experimenting in that way. So that's the project. Yeah.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Did you have a challenge with getting continuity frame by frame of these textures?
Yeah, I think like what you see basically is this kind of jitteringness that happens throughout, that is sort of consistent actually, that it's not stable between frames, and that's because it's basically each time the camera moves, it's basically constructing the image. It's not as, how would you say, yeah, it's just not as consistent.
Right, so each like time it's each beat, one is a new
totally
process.
New output,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Thank you. Yes. Jane? Can you tell us prep this video a little bit and tell us about the project?
Yeah, sure. So in the last year, since I really started getting into making AI art, I've trained, I think, close to 100 StyleGAN models using data that I've collected mostly by hand or with some like generative processes. And so as I've been training these different models and transfer learning from one model to another, I became really interested in the idea of chroma keying training data, so removing backgrounds and then like masking out the objects, and then taking the latent walk output videos and chroma keying those also, in order to kind of escape the, you know, the box of the video. And since then have been kind of iterating more on like bringing those now cut out masked videos into post-processing, like 3D rendering software and things like that. And so I was thinking about, I was wondering like what kinds of objects might be interesting to do this masking process on. And so this video, which you can play now if you want, is from a model that I trained on houseplants. I think that we'll talk a little bit more a little later on about kind of the ethics of training data. I think that there are different use cases where it might be ethically acceptable or not to scrape data from places. My opinion for this model, I am very much an adherent of the idea of steal like an artist. I was shopping for houseplants online and then suddenly being followed around by all of these digital display advertisements from Amazon and Lowe's and Home Depot and stuff for plants. And so that was part of my like inspiration, and where I got my training data was actually recursively scraping those websites and stealing like an artist. So obviously I'm not selling these so that's kind of the story behind this model.
Great. And we have a little bit on the process here.
Yeah, so the other thing was when I was scraping these plants, I was using machine learning also for the masking process, and a lot of the potted plants had white pots and they were on white backgrounds, and so the masking process couldn't differentiate between pot and background, and so I ended up with a bunch of these kind of naked plants that had no pots. Simultaneously, I didn't have as much training data as I wanted to have. I think I had about 5,000 images, and you really need a lot of images in order to get a nice result from StyleGAN. And so I had the idea to, in addition to stealing plants, I started stealing pots as well. And I created these plant pot adjacency matrices. Down the column, I listed all of my pots, and then across the top, I listed all of my plants. In a former life, I was a graphic designer, so this was using Adobe Illustrator. So collecting training data has been kind of like a meditative process for me, and so this was definitely very time consuming, but I manually, digitally repotted all of these plants. And so that was how I artificially increased my training data size with these plant pot adjacency matrices. And so you can see the GIF on the far right there are all of those manually repotted plants that I used to artificially increase my training data size.
Amazing, thank you. I'm Ryan Groves. I run a company called Infinite Album, where we generate music for Twitch live streamers. And as I was saying, this is the example I was talking about earlier, where we can generate music from scratch and adapt the emotion of the music in real time. And so what we're exploring right now is automatically generating, visuals of that generated audio. And this is a collaboration we did. And I think this also highlights sort of just how layered, specifically like neural models can be. In this situation, we're actually modifying the spatial noise input, which gives you this sort of, you'll see this sort of like magic eye sort of sense of this audio. So this is generated audio. This is actually an artist collaboration with MiroShot as well. So we took their song and sort of trained the AI to regenerate the song. Take a look. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and so then another thing that I'm working on is, you know, organizing the AI song contest. So I just wanted to give you a sense of, you know, the types of submissions that happen there. So this is a little clip from the winner of our 2020 contest, and the name of the artist is Uncanny Valley. They're an Australian group, hence the koala face there at the end. So when we were talking backstage, Jane, you brought up this really interesting thing, which is the juxtaposition between your goals with generated output as a researcher versus an artist. Could you recap that? I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anyone that's ever tried to re-implement an algorithm from a paper may find that their results don't quite match the results in the paper. And that's like a really bad thing in research when we cherry pick our results and publish them, and it, you know, contributes to the reproducibility crisis. But what's really interesting about AI art is that cherry picking is exactly what we're doing. It's, you know, a major reason why I think that, you know, I make a clear distinction between saying this was made with AI and not made by AI, is because the artist in the loop is a really important part of that process. So just cherry picking data is kind of what we do as creative people.
Yeah, and I think it's so fascinating too that the language is even different around it, right? So cherry picking has sort of a negative connotation of like, oh, you're cheating the system by choosing, you know, the best example. And in the art world, with a lot of these models, the terminology is actually curation, which has a very sort of positive vibe. You know, it's like curating a gallery. So a lot of times when you sift through a lot of generated material, they use the word curate to sort of like, you know, extract those examples that are the best, and some, maybe you'll feed those examples back into the model. So you're sort of like cultivating this style in a machine learning model. But it's so funny because they're so juxtaposed. It's like so negative and so like positive. So Delina, I mean, I think you have the most, well, not the most experience necessarily, but you have a lot of experience with this through this project, since obviously all of our panelists have experience with this. But could you tell me a little bit more about the process of like of selecting those images?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. I kind of think of it like when you're editing a paper or even an interview or something, and there's like just a bunch of filler stuff that you don't want to really show, and you just edit it out, that's not a problem. But like, I think because we're entering two different fields where there's sort of, you know, a methodology around research and then a methodology, or maybe like more of an openness towards it when it comes to creating stuff, sort of like finding where that bridge is. And I think with the project that I was working on, there were so many failures. Like if I were to just show you exactly what I generated on first render, it would be really bad. And it was just a matter of sort of figuring out, learning how the process works, like how the algorithms work, and, you know, the data set that I was using. So I didn't even actually train my own, you know, data set. So I'm kind of curious about, like, you know, like how many images you actually need to produce a certain level or quality, but also really interested in that maybe it's not the highest fidelity and I don't necessarily need that control over something as well. And just being interested in maybe the like in-between space that it exists in at the stage that I've encountered the project and the research. So it's really interesting to sort of have that, that, you know, the like being present with whatever exists and being able to work with it as a tool in that moment, and maybe also, yeah, editing things out that that for me, or curating things that are that fit the vision of the project a little bit more. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is something we see quite a lot in the AI song contest, because, you know, last year we had 38 teams and we had to judge all of these processes, and there wasn't a single format for a process. We deliberately leave it open to interpretation of, like, you know, how you're co-creating with artificial intelligence. And so we find that people go from, you know, generating lyrics to describe a particular cultural emotion. There was one Korean team, and they were trying to describe the emotion of Han, which is basically like collective loss, as far as I understood it. So they spent a lot of their time just trying to teach a lyric generator how to understand that emotion. So they were like adding, you know, sadness plus community plus guilt plus loss. And then, you know, in the musical process, there wasn't actually that much AI input per se. But that's still, you know, that's sort of what we look for, is like, how did this augment the creative process? And so it's quite wide open, I think. And what's interesting to me as well, which I wanted to touch on, is, you know, and maybe Hans, you can help me out with this. I think there's certain models that enable you to grab like a pre-trained model and then sort of cultivate or add additional training so that you can sort of like hone how you want that model to behave. And Hans, could you tell me like sort of what the magnitude of the scale of the data is for those sort of two separate things? I think that'd be pretty interesting to...
Yeah, okay. I think this is also something that Jane touched on earlier as well. It's called transfer learning. So generally, especially for a model like StyleGAN, where it's learning to generate something from essentially nothing, you're just giving it random values, you need a lot of data to get good results. And it's especially well designed for things that are kind of structurally similar. So I'm sure you've all, or many of you have seen the faces that don't exist, but those are all kind of centered and the face is always kind of the same. And even with such easy data like that, where it's clear that there's always kind of an interpolation between one face and the other, you need like 30 to 50,000 high resolution images of faces. And so faces, there's tons of pictures of it, but there's a lot of data where this isn't necessarily the case, where it's not that easy to get so many high resolution images. So transfer learning is kind of, the idea is to start out with a model that's been trained on one data set, hopefully kind of close to the domain that you're focused on, because this model has learned some kind of internal latent representation that understands how images are constructed. And so a lot of that knowledge is useful for other domains as well. So you take the same model and you just keep on training for a little bit longer with your smaller set of data. And so if you train too long, then it'll kind of collapse and really overfit to those images. And so what you often see then is that either it'll only generate like one static image or it won't interpolate nicely. But if you're just in the sweet spot of training it for a short amount of time, then you get kind of a really nice blend from the original model towards your desired domain. And so this is a really cool way of kind of leveraging models that are published by researchers that make it easier for people at home who don't have a cluster of 60 GPUs to train with to just run it either on their own local gaming hardware or maybe in the cloud via a collab notebook. But yeah, so that I think that's one of the most interesting from an artistic perspective developments of the kind of open source nature of a lot of the modern machine learning research.
Cool. Thanks. And Delina, I was wondering what when you use these AI models, do you know what data they were trained on, or like how much of that did you look into when you were in this creative process?
Yeah, I mean that's the thing is like they were just these pre-trained models I downloaded and I was able to use them off the bat, but they were trained on basically I think yeah it's 160,000 over 160,000 images on Flickr. And they're all images that basically are either landscape, some humans, usually full-bodied humans, and still life images, so fruits, vegetables, like gardens, like, so there's like a host of these images that end up becoming annotated, and so they become sort of labeled, basically. So if you have a landscape image of, for instance, say, a sky with clouds, trees, a mountain, grass, right, like basic landscape image, these get annotated by hand, which is actually pretty interesting because I'm sure this is like, you know, interesting topic on labor that sort of just gets wiped out from the conversation. But someone actually has to annotate all of these and then they get stored and categorized together. And so the image that I generated in 3D in the scene is I would basically have a value between 0 and 1 in decimal places that would represent one of the categories. So if I have a 3D asset of a tree, I would give it the material that is related to the actual color value associated with a tree, and it would basically composite the photographic, the generated photographic image onto that 3D asset when it's fully processed. But that's as far as the knowledge that I know in terms of what I'm using. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think we're going to run out of time, and we were going to touch on ethics, but I think that might be a panel of itself. but I did. I guess we can highlight sort of from the top level. I think the labor idea, first of all, is like also a whole nother topic of, you know, who has created these images, and was that a fair practice in order to create these images? There was an example of a larger company, OpenAI, which, you know, a lot of people were asking me if there's a space between open and AI in the title of this talk, because they're a really prominent company. And they created this thing called Jukebox, where they were able to generate music in the style of an artist conditioned on lyrics. So you could actually make, you know, Elvis Presley, for example, sing a new melody. And what they did is they just basically put every song that they could find into this training data set. And all of those songs have rights. You know, the people that created those songs have rights on these songs. So it actually can be a very big issue. And it's not necessarily ethical. I mean, they were doing it sort of more in the research context, but they are a for-profit company. There's been a lot of like, you know, discussion around that, and I think that can be a problem. On the other hand, it's such an incredible tool, right? So like having these, not everybody has the ability to pre-train, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of data points, because it requires quite a lot of CPU. And there's this sort of interplay where, you know, as an artist and you look at it as a tool that just performs something for you, and then you make it your own. But it's very easy to, you know, at some point you're actually leveraging the work of other people. So I think it's sort of a double-edged sword in that case. And Jane, do you use a lot of pre-trained models, or do you kind of just train all of your models yourself?
Yeah, I've started with transfer learning from existing pre-trained models, and then now the point that I'm at currently is that I have these sort of genealogies of transfer learning, right? So back in March of last year, I trained on macro photography of plants. And actually, with regard to training data, so when I'm scraping images, like with that plant, the plant model that I showed before, I'm not using those images in a marketing context, and so I don't really see that as problematic. But with my more photography-based models, those ones I'm only using royalty-free stock images, and I actually have CSV files of all of the credits for all of the thousands of images that go into those models. And so I had scraped, I think it was Unsplash and Pexels were the two websites that I used for this model that I trained on macro photography of plants. And a lot of them had raindrops or dewdrops on the plants. And then later on, when I wanted to train a model on raindrops on glass, I transfer learned from that morning dew model that I had trained. And it, the system basically learned the shape of raindrops really well because it had already kind of learned them from that plants model. So even though the colors were different and the technically the domain was different, the small visual aspects were similar enough that it was good for transfer learning.
That's so cool. That's a good idea. I think we're running out of time if we want to give it 5 minutes to take some questions. So I wanted to first of all let you know that I think we'll tweet. We have a Google Doc. Jane has a Google Doc of tools and models that are available. So we'll tweet that out after. So if you want to follow us, our Twitter or Instagram handles are there on the screen. And I wanted to thank my panelists for joining me today. This was such a great discussion.
Yeah, so thank you for hosting.
Thank you very much for having us.
I see we have a question. Do you want to come to the mic?
Yeah, thank you. I just didn't want to come up here and pressure you guys.
No problem.
So I have a bunch of questions, and especially coming from a deep learning side and then coming here and seeing music and seeing that's a whole world. But there's one particular question I had because I trained my own model but kind of fell on the ethics. So I had questions about synthetic data generation and kind of what you guys think about that, because that's kind of one of the ways that I've tried to skew towards, I'm generating random data and kind of, I gave a talk on sort of the, if it doesn't sound like human music, then that's kind of the point, because we should learn to appreciate it the way that it sounds funky, and I didn't know about your competition, so, but I just wanted to put that out there as kind of synthetic data as an ethical way of doing it. Obviously, you have to train something to generate that synthetic data, but kind of how that works in the workflow. And I have a follow-up question for Delina afterwards, but if not, I can reach out to you if we don't have time for a second one, or no one else has questions.
I can take this one, I guess, because this is something that I've thought about and worked with in a professional setting as well. But I think one of the biggest things about these models is kind of chaining together the different outputs of different networks. So just like Jane, I have a folder of hundreds or maybe even thousands of trained networks. And what I often do is I recycle these outputs and then train a new model on kind of the outputs of the last generation. And I think this is something that lets you be transformative with the original inputs, because I'm also a lot of the time just scraping these from online. I mean, I've been collecting images since I was 15, and so I already had folders and folders of images just because that was something that I was doing. But these are all images with rights, and so I really try to think, can you kind of distinguish my work, my outputs from the original work? If it's clear that it's from exactly that, then I don't think I've done enough. And so I think that's really important in the artistic process, is to really pull it through a filter until it really is only recognizable as something that you've made.
Yeah, I would also add that I love synthetic data generation as a precursor step. I'm actually a small plug. I'm speaking at NVIDIA GTC next week on Wednesday, more about this, you know, leveraging machine learning and artistic workflows. And one thing that I've done before is HiDT is like a high resolution daylight translation. And so with that one, I've, you know, taken, again, royalty-free stock images, but then you can change the time of day. There's also like seasonal translation, so you can also increase the, you know, your training data size with some of those other kinds of, you know, existing models.
Cool. I know we had a question earlier. Did you still have the question?
Well, I had a different question, but now I have a better question, so I'm going to ask that one.
That's okay.
So my question's for Delaina, or all of you, but it's kind of this relationship of process and computational power and kind of like and rendering and the reality of that and how much that influences. So I have no idea how much render time all this takes. So that's, you know, it's like, how much do you need? What kind of video card do you need? What kind, you know, how much RAM, blah, blah, blah. But I imagine at some point you have to stop, right? You have to be like, okay, I can't do this anymore. And so I'm just kind of curious about that relationship and how, you know, how you deal with that. Because when I used to do a lot of compositing work, there was always that point, you're like, I don't care if that one thing, like, I just, I don't care. I don't want to do this anymore. So, yeah, like, I feel like that's an interesting space, and it has that labor element to it.
Yeah, I think that's actually where I operate. That's a really good question. Is, I mean, in general, when I was doing just 3D renders, and if anyone knows about 3D rendering, especially, like, I was working with cycles, and you would need a lot of computation power. And the other thing is, like, it's not, like, real-time rendering, where you would basically, what you see is what you get. You would put something together and then you'd be like, okay, I think that's what I want. And then you'd render it and it would take like 2 minutes for a still image. And then you'd get something and you're like, I don't like that. Then you keep going. So it's sort of the same process, but it's a little bit faster now. So especially working, and when I started working with compositing, it was actually a lot faster than 3D rendering. And I really enjoyed that. And then when I worked with real-time rendering with game engines and all this stuff, it was amazing. So I basically enjoyed kind of putting together pieces that helped the creative workflow rather than just the technical workflow. And that allowed for me to have a lot more leverage over being able to control what I wanted to have control over and what I knew I wouldn't have control over. And so, yeah, I would at some point experiment to the point where it's like the images are not coming out the way I want to, so I'm going to keep going. But then at some point it was like, it's good, so I'm just going to, like, you know, render this, and that's it, you know. And yeah, so it is like a balance of that, and it's kind of what I enjoy about that process as well. And AI actually allows for a lot of that to happen because you don't have control over everything. While in 3D rendering, you want to, and maybe in compositing as well, especially with green screen, you want to have control over every aspect. But with AI, at least you know that the computer has to do some of that leverage for you, and so you allow for that to happen. Yeah.
If I could just chime in here as well. I think in my work, this is also pretty a pretty clear point of difficulty, I guess, is when is the image good enough? Like these models that you're training, they are really black boxes, and so it's really hard to see these training dynamics and understand if the images are going to turn out nice. And so, I mean, because I have like a couple of GPUs that are sitting in my living room just blowing all day every day, and if you train one of these models from scratch, it just takes 2 weeks, and you're just like every morning you just check on it real quick. And so you do get kind of intermediate outputs that you can see. And at a certain point, things are interesting enough and varied enough that I'm like, all right, let me just try and render a video and see if I like it. And what's really cool about StyleGAN in particular, it's taken me a little bit of work, but the last couple months I've been working on getting the rendering in real time. So once you've gone through this training process, you can get really interactive results and just start tweaking a knob and seeing how that affects the image on screen. And I think that's a really gratifying interactive experience, is that at that point, you've put in your time, and now you get to play with the kind of the fully fledged model.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Delaina, I actually had a question, and then I think we have to get off the stage. But did you find in your creative process, did you lose material
that you liked that you had rendered before? Like, because there's sort of so much randomness with AI, I feel like there's quite an opportunity to, like, lose.
Yeah, actually, I used a completely different data set before using this one, and it, like, had really interesting images, and it was actually more accurate, so, like, a human actually looked like an uncanny human, but then between the frames, it was way too jittery. So this is actually a little bit more, like, consistent temporally than the one that I was using previously, and I had to scrap it even though, like, the images were beautiful on their own as still images. So it was interesting to see, like, using different data sets and how they were sort of synthesized, changed the, yeah, like, basically what I chose, like, the decisions I made. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I bet Hans has some ideas how you can fix that as well.
That'd be great. Yeah, this is great. I'm learning a lot too, because I, like, do not do the, like, technical side at all, really. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining our panel, and we'll be around if you want to talk afterwards if you have more questions.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.